Support for the Source Podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org. This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
I'll share my world with you. Everything that I own, my earthly possessions, they're no good if I'm alone.
Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. George Jones is remembered for being possibly the best vocalist in the history of country music, but he's also remembered for his turbulent life and his troubled romance and marriage with Tammy Wynette, also a country music superstar. The story has fascinated generations, but how much of it is true, how much has been embellished or just purely invented? Tyler Mahan Coe has produced a hit podcast and authored a new book that honors the talent but tears down some of the facades surrounding Jones and Wynette. His podcast and book is called Cocaine and Rhinestones. The second season covers the couple's story, but also looks at it in the context of history and in the human condition. And Tyler Mahan Coe, welcome to The Source.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, congratulations on the success of the podcast and this fantastic book that you have. It is quite dense. It's intense, kind of like you. You seem very exacting in the way that you present this information. You don't compromise in how you really want people to understand the relationship, the music, and the quality and the integrity of it. Can you talk about that?
Of course, yeah. Well, my father is David Allan Coe, so I was sort of born into country music. You know, he was still signed to Epic Records when I was born, produced by the same producer as George Jones and Tammy Wynette. So you could say I've had sort of an insider's perspective on this, but then also much later, my father did not have a record deal and he sort of lived year round on tour, and I joined his band as his touring guitarist for close to 13 years. So I also have a deep familiarity with the ground level perspective on this. You know, I wasn't just inside the system broadcasting this stuff. I was also out on the ground and seeing the conversations that folks were having about it. So I really have always been aware of the disparity between how George and Tammy are viewed by fans versus the reality of the situation. And I feel there is a lot to gain by understanding more of the truth about what went on. I think this story is far more fascinating when you know what really happened versus just believing the, you know, tidy, convenient narratives that sort of reduces these complex human beings to stereotypical country artists, you know, just a one-dimensional character, which both George and Tammy were anything but that.
Even in some of the recent retelling, like the Showtime series, George and Tammy, they don't exactly deliver complex characters. They seem to get the personalities wrong. That's according to you and your analysis of that series. Why is it so hard for outsiders to understand the inner workings of country music and the people who make it?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. My personal belief is that it ties back to what I call an authenticity fetish. There's this idea that particularly fans and journalists and artists coming to country music from a background in pop or rock, they tend to project this ideal of quote unquote realness or authenticity onto country. And someone like Bruce Springsteen, who was just being discussed, he has really profited off of that, sort of adopting aspects of what is seen as a more authentic, usually working class type persona. And these people want country music to be that way. Whereas those of us who've grown up listening to country music our whole lives understand that it's a show. Usually, historically, if there was a performer on a country music show who went out of their way to dress up as if they came from a poor or working class background, that performer was a comedian on a show with country singers, like Minnie Pearl keeping the price tag on her hat. And, you know, many other bands, it would usually be the bass player in like an old timey string band or bluegrass band. The bass player would have like a comedy act and he would wear these ridiculous suspenders and black out a tooth, but it was a comedy act and we were laughing at it. But then, you know, folks from the city see it and they think that we're just a bunch of yokels, like recognizing one of our own up there, when really the whole thing is a joke about class constructs and things of that nature. And then on the other side of that spectrum, you have the whole rhinestone suit aspect of country fashion. There's literally nothing that is quote unquote authentic or working class about someone turning themselves into a disco ball to sing some songs, you know.
Well, it's a display of wealth, ostentation. But it to me, reminds me of the mariachi suit as well.
Well, yes, that's something that I take a lot of time belaboring, that connection in the book. I don't believe that we would arrive at the modern conception of a rhinestone suit without the clothing that was worn in Spanish bullfights. Yeah.
Right. And so are you a trained journalist? Are you a historian? Or you just came by this through in your blood?
I am a high school dropout and a convicted felon. So I really haven't had many other avenues available to me. You know, looking back at my life, it is almost as if a bunch of things happened in perfect sequence that led me to this. I never really had any ambitions toward being a published author, never thought of myself as someone who would take up a position of authority on the history of country music. This has been my life. I've been reading books about this stuff and disappointed in a lot of books that I read about this stuff my whole life. And once podcasts became popular and I saw that was becoming the way that a lot of folks like to hear their stories these days, I looked into a country music podcast just because I wanted to listen to one. I assumed someone must be telling all these stories that I know about country music history. And I could not find anyone doing it. So at that point, it became a sense of responsibility for me. I felt like I had to do it because nobody else was doing it and all this stuff was going to get forgotten.
Well, we're going to be talking more about that. We're going to hear more about Tammy Wynette and George Jones. The book is Cocaine and Rhinestones, the history of this couple. We're having a conversation with Taylor Mahan Coe. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. A couple gazes at the wedding rings, their own display. She smiles and nods her head as he says, honey, that's for you. It's not much, but it's the best that I can do. Golden ring, golden ring, with one tiny little stone waiting there, waiting there for someone to take it home. Just a cold metallic thing, only love can make a golden wedding ring. In a little wedding chapel, later on that
Support for TPR comes from Jingu House in the Japanese Tea Garden, featuring Asian cuisine with a San Antonio twist. Open for lunch 7 days a week. View the menu at jinguhousesatx.com. After all, he's just a man. Stand by your man. Give him two arms to cling to.
Summer nights are cold and lonely. Stand by your man.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Tyler Mahan Coe. His book is Cocaine and Rhinestones, A History of George Jones and Tammy Wynette. You may have heard his podcast. It is a top podcast, which he crafted on just out of sheer gumption. He made it happen, and it just got better and better along the way. And that was Stand By Your Man, a cultural touchstone by Tammy Wynette. And Tyler, there's a lot of story behind that song.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's certainly one of the most famous recordings in the English language, and it was sort of crafted from the beginning to become the center of this socio-political conversation. It's the height of the women's liberation movement, and Tammy Wynette's producer, Billy Sherrill, was a man of conservative politics, but above and beyond that, was adept at manipulating controversy in order to sell records, essentially, in order to place his artist and their songs at the center of a national conversation that he saw happening. And he very deliberately took sort of an iconoclastic stance on women's liberation, which, it should be said, Tammy Wynette also agreed with. She herself was would be viewed as a conservative by today's standards. So they made
a song.
Yeah, but
when she started in the music business, she found out pretty quickly that it was a man's world, and there weren't many opportunities for female country singers. And she set out to change that. And she certainly benefited from, opportunities created by the women's liberation movement. So, so people have pointed out that it's like there's a lot of hypocrisy in this song. But then again, you really tell the story of like it's a song. It was created in order to sell records, to generate revenue, and to appeal to a population that was hungry for this.
Yes, Tammy's story of becoming a major label recording artist is one of her getting turned down a lot initially, and really a lot of luck was involved. She had gone around to all these different producers, and as you say, there was a very limited number of positions available for women to get signed to recording contracts. She kept being told the label couldn't sign her because they already had two women on the label and they didn't have room for a third. And she just happened to come in to pitch Billy Sherrill at a moment when he had this plan to sort of cover this other record and it didn't work out. And Tammy Wynette just happened to be there. So he sort of just, you come here. And then they go in and record some songs and start getting some minor hits. And then Stand By Your Man is something that he had already been working on for a few years. And Tammy's career was picking up steam, so he decided, well, we'll try this song out with her.
Well, you say there's market research at the time that showed who was most likely to buy a country music record, and that was women. And it was a largely market that was not really being served.
Yes, and there were several different markets that he realized weren't being served, which was conservative women who disagreed with a lot of what they were seeing in the women's liberation movement. And that messaging is consistent throughout a lot of Tammy Wynette's biggest hit songs, a very conservative viewpoint on the role that a woman should serve in society. And if she doesn't serve that role, then she's going to be miserable, essentially. And then also Tammy Wynette was already known to have gone through divorces at the very beginning of her career, which that in itself could have been a controversy at the time, just being a divorced woman. But Billy Sherrill realized that a lot of women were divorced women. So they leaned into that controversy and sort of held Tammy up as an example of a divorced woman, and hopefully other women would hear her singing about that and relate, which is absolutely what happened.
And so do you think Tammy Wynette brought something unique to the song that no one else could have delivered?
Oh, I think so, probably. I think Tammy Wynette's a great singer. I love her songs and her recordings. But she herself and everyone at the time, she's being compared to other singers like Patsy Cline and Connie Smith, just virtuoso vocalists. So the consensus on Tammy at the time was that she technically wasn't like the greatest singer around in Nashville, like didn't have the greatest range or anything like that, but she did have this thing that she could do, which was a very dynamic technique of taking her voice very loud and then going back to quiet, and she could put this emotion of sadness into it while doing it, which is not something that even those virtuoso vocalists could do. I can't imagine that the song would have been as big of a hit as it is if Patsy Cline or Connie Smith had recorded it. You know, I think it takes Tammy Wynette's unique vocal to do that.
I'm going to play another song from her. Could be seen as, I mean, all these songs are kind of, that she recorded or looked at, as you talk about it, as they were, are they messaging or are they just songs? Let's hear another one, I Don't Want to Play House.
And I hung my head in shame when I heard our little girl say to him, I don't want to play house, I know it can't be fun. I've watched mommy and daddy, and if that's the way.
And so, Tyler, can you kind of put the pieces together for me?
Certainly. I do believe that a lot of folks just love the way these songs sounded without thinking much about the, you know, political messaging that could have gone into it. With that song specifically, there is a recording technique that I think is probably what appeals to a lot of folks, which is it was very standard for a singer to record their own harmony part. So when you're listening to a song and you hear that singer's voice coming at you twice in two different registers, it's because
overdub.
Later they would go back and overdub a second vocal track, which, you know, sounds a lot better than just having someone else singing along with them. But the unique thing about Tammy Wynette is she did not have a lot of experience in the recording studio. So the first time they had her do of her own vocal overdubs, she did it much differently than anyone else would. And it sort of led to this, I think it's almost like psychedelic. It reminds me a lot of sounds that were coming from lead guitar parts in San Francisco in the 60s, around roughly the same time period as this, where they were getting into multi-tracking guitars. Her voice kind of does a lot of the same stuff, and it is captivating to listen to no matter what she's singing about.
So, but Tammy Wynette, she presented herself in a very particular way to her fans. What was the character that she crafted that she wanted the fans to see her as?
Very much the character in songs like Stand By Your Man, I Don't Want to Play House, D-I-V-O-R-C-E. It was a sort of a woman who can only be defined by the romantic relationships that she's in with men. And then we would be given slices of that character's story. At the beginning of a relationship, she would be happy and, you know, just giddy in love. And then sort of in the middle part, the man would start running around on her and she would be at home just loving him regardless and hoping that no matter what he was out there doing, eventually he would come home and deign to give her some attention. And then sort of the end of that cycle would be the man has gone and Tammy blames herself and really is just sort of eating away at her that she couldn't make that relationship work. And then it all starts over again with the next relationship. I mean, really almost all of her biggest hit singles can fit somewhere in that cycle.
Run, Run, Back to Your Man. I'll be home cooking breakfast when you come home, stuff like that in her lyrics. But, you know, you tell the story that Tammy Wynette is an unreliable narrator. She she's a liar. She's a conniver. She was very ambitious, a climber. So she was actually much more than that.
Well, yeah, it is. It sort of tells a whole different story once you start realizing that. And this started to become a problem with the publication of her autobiography. It contradicted itself in so many ways. She would say one thing and then five paragraphs later start describing something else that completely contradicts what she had said a moment ago. And this is when a lot of people started to realize, oh, maybe this person is not actually telling me the truth about who they are and what happened. And a lot of folks who were, you know, there at the time have later gone on record saying that that is exactly the case. And it really became a problem with her because in her songs, the character that she's presenting to the audience is someone who is sort of a victim of other bad actors, the bad behavior of other people in her life. And then when you look at the real story, it turns out she is the one that is actually causing a lot of the problems. A typical Tammy Wynette song will warn you about some woman who's going to come after your man and steal him away from you. And in real life, she was going to come after your man and steal him away from you.
Yeah, but she was very jealous, needed constant attention and validation, needed to be, just looked after. There was a lot going on there. She was high maintenance in a lot of ways.
Yes, what I see is someone who sort of formed a concept of how society works while in high school and kind of never really got past that. Even well into adulthood, when she was speaking of matters between a man and a woman, she consistently would use the words boys and girls, you know, even like well past middle age. She's talking about how girls are and boys are. And a lot of the things that she did seem like someone trying to, you know, generate drama in high school. It's pretty sad, actually, once you start seeing it from that perspective.
Yeah, and when you see her story, that's where she basically got married right out of high school when she was an early young 18. And her grandmother, she was living with her grandmother, was very strict with her about that. And she grew up extremely poor, picking cotton literally in Mississippi. And her rise from poverty to becoming extremely successful in country music, I mean, that is an accomplishment. You just didn't happen by accident. You really have to work for that.
Well, so that, what you just said is actually like her version of events. So okay. It turns out she actually like was not that poor. Her grandfather owned a large farm. A lot of the kids that she went to school with, right, their parents worked on that farm. She was the prom queen.
I'm going to get into all that because this is important stuff, and I want to have more time to talk about that. We're going to take another break here. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about the history of George Jones and Tammy Wynette. Stand by.
Each other. Life can be rough. Sometimes it's kind. A real good life is hard to find. But the best love is the one we know. And the faith we have between us makes it grow.
Some love lives, and some love don't.
This program is recorded from an earlier live broadcast.
I spell out all the hurt words and turn my head when I speak. Cause I can't spell away this hurt that's dripping down my cheek. Our D-I-B-O-R-C-E. Because
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the book and the podcast, Cocaine and Rhinestones, The History of George Jones and Tammy Wynette. We're with the author and the host and the producer of the podcast and the book, Tyler Mahan Coe. You can call in with questions and comments. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Tyler, let's talk more about George Jones, the possum, given that name because some people said he had a look that was similar to that of an American possum. You know, he was an established star. He was quite a little bit older than Tammy Wynette, but they managed to fall in love. But did she orchestrate that arrangement?
I think that would be fair to say, yeah, at the time, Jones was married, but hopelessly in love with his singing partner, a young woman named Melba Montgomery. And they recorded a lot of fantastic music together, if anyone hasn't heard that. But Melba recognized that Jones was an alcoholic and a very troubled person, not someone that it would be wise for her to get into a romantic relationship with. So he was sort of lovesick at the time that Tammy Wynette came to town. And as you said, he was not only an established singer, but widely regarded by country fans as the greatest living country singer, greatest country singer ever. Tammy Wynette definitely believed him to be that. So when their professional circles sort of intersected and she started being around him, it was really only a matter of time before she had orchestrated a situation to where they would be singing together. And he replaced her singing partner at the time, which was a guy named David Houston. And Tammy was married at the time, but that didn't seem to matter much to her, and it didn't seem to matter much to Jones. And I believe it's accurate to say that he sort of transferred his obsession for Melba Montgomery over to Tammy Wynette. And then he and Tammy sort of mutually projected onto each other this fairy tale romance that they would have. And of course, that turned out to not be what happened.
The addictive personality. Let's listen to a little bit of George Jones right here.
I'll be over you when the rest grows old. When you left, I thought that I would soon get over you. Even told myself that I would find somebody to. Time and tears have come and gone.
And so, Tyler, what's the significance of this song as we're talking about the coming together of George Jones and Tammy Wynette?
Jones' vocal performance there is phenomenal. He does this thing where he moves where his voice is coming from in his body. He moves it between the different resonating chambers of the body. So like you could hear he's introducing lows from his chest, and then he moves it up into his throat, and then it goes up into his nasal cavity. Just truly phenomenal stuff. And
that's why, I mean, no one else can do that. I mean, it's just using all these registers in order to really, he's using his voice as an instrument.
Exactly. And then beyond that, that's just how he's moving his voice around. He's also doing all these other things with his mouth. He'll do this thing where he sort of bites down and almost hums a lyric into the back of his teeth. It's a lot of stuff.
The breath control.
Absolutely. You don't hear a lot of people doing there. You certainly didn't hear a lot of people doing it before he did it, you know, and then after he did it, a lot of other folks came along and started doing it because, you know, they recognized the appeal of it. But when the grass grows over me was written by Don Chapel. That's what you're referring to, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
Yes. So this is who Tammy Wynette was with. And George Jones came to record this song by having it being pitched to him by Don Chapel. And he actually brought Tammy with him to meet his, you know, then at the time fiance, this was her hero, so he thought he would impress her by bringing her along to the meeting. And little did he know that was not a great idea if he hoped to stay married to Tammy Wynette.
So when Tammy Wynette, did she like set her sights like George Jones is someone, I mean, she had an attraction for, she was primed to fall in love with him, and she was going to make sure that George Jones fell in love with her. They had a relationship, kind of like, as Don Chappelle says, like not behind his back, but right in front of him.
Yeah, it's one of those. So Don Chappell was a very ambitious person who kind of only saw everyone else for what they could bring to him, what they could do to advance his own career. So when George and Tammy are on tour, Don Chappell is also on tour, and he has made himself a part of Tammy Wynette's stage show, and you know, really inserted himself in a way that he would not have been in that position were he not romantically involved with Tammy Wynette. His own talents as a performer would not have put him there. So it's sort of a pretentious guy. Definitely when Tammy started spending a lot of time with Jones, it's very likely that Chappell only saw that as being good for him. Oh, this is great. My wife is about to become George Jones' singing partner. This is going to bring much more visibility to her career, which will bring much more visibility to me. And he just somehow didn't realize until it was far too late that what he was actually watching was his wife just leave him in the past.
Yeah, so on the tour bus, he put his name above Tammy Wynette. Did he see himself? Was he a performer? Was he a draw?
As a performer, certainly not. I think that Don Chappell was a really good songwriter, though. I mean, the biggest hit song that George Jones ever had was He Stopped Loving Her Today. And if you look at that song and look at When the Grass Grows Over Me, When the Grass Grows Over Me predicts the theme of He Stopped Loving Her Today. It's about the exact same thing, you know. So he recognized something about George Jones' ability to sell that theme years in advance of George Jones selling that theme better than anyone else ever did it. So I think he was certainly very talented. I don't believe he ever had a chance at becoming a star as a singer, though, which is what he wanted beyond just being a songwriter.
Walk through this world with me, go where I go, share all the dreams with me, I need you so, in life we search, and some of us find. I've looked for you a long, long time.
And so who wouldn't want someone to sing a song like that to them? But, and you can hear not just the great vocalization, but the emotion, emoting coming through that song. You really feel like he really, really means it. And sober, he'd be a great guy. The problem was that he wasn't always sober. What would happen to him when he got hold of a bottle, Tyler?
Oh, God. It was bad. I mean, so Jones was a victim of child abuse. His father was an abusive alcoholic. And what can often happen with children who are in that situation is they, you know, they love their parents, so they assume that if they are being abused by a parent, that they deserve it. They have done something to deserve it, or if they haven't done something to deserve it, there's something about who they are inherently that is bad, and that's why they are being quote-unquote punished for being bad. So starting from there and then getting into music and naturally gravitating towards the honky tonks where the music that he loved so much was being performed, which in turn was a place where he was exposed to alcohol and started drinking alcohol. It was just almost immediately a bad relationship with alcohol. He's a very small guy physically, but if he got drunk, it wouldn't take much for him to decide someone was insulting him, and he would get in a fight with the biggest guy in the bar, get all hurt, you know.
And it became an abusive person. And that also was part of the relationship between the two. We're going to take another break here. We'll be back. Continue our conversation. Cocaine, Rhinestones, the history of George Jones and Tammy Wynette. Stay with us.
Deep Rocky Mountains, a happy woman, a happy man. We thought our love would go on forever, side by side. But here we stand like strangers at the great divide.
Our way to the top of life.
Kept some letters by his bed. Did in 1962. He had underlined in red every single I love. I went to see him just today. Oh, but I didn't see no tears. All dressed up to go away. First time I'd seen him smile in years. He stopped loving her. Placed a wreath upon his door, and soon they'll carry him away. He stopped loving her.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Tyler Mahan Coe, he produces a podcast that tells these stories about country music. He did season two dedicated to the history of George Jones and Tammy Wynette. The name of the podcast and a new book that is compiled with this information is called Cocaine and Rhinestones. And Tyler, we had to play that song because once you mention Stop Loving Her Today, it becomes an itch that cannot be scratched until you hear that song. I mean, it's so phenomenal. And when you talk about an artist who could only sing that particular song, this is it. Can you get your reaction?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I think there's a reason why you didn't see a bunch of other country artists immediately rush out to record covers of that song after it became a hit, which was a very typical thing in the genre at the time. Someone had a hit song, a bunch of other country artists would record it. No one wanted to touch that one after George Jones sang it. It was like, I think he did about as best as you can do there.
Yeah, and so people read into that song about their relationship with Tammy Wynette, you know. So, and that's part of, I guess, the appeal of George Jones and many other country music artists, that people do want to know their personal stories, and then they apply them to what their songs are. I mean, that did happen here, although the song was not written for that. But that became, you know, part of the calculus.
Yes. Well, much like Billy Sherrill intentionally crafted Stand By Your Man to play into a national conversation that was already happening, he would do the same thing on a smaller scale with each individual artist if they happened to have sort of a presence in entertainment media, as Tammy Wynette did. Stand By Your Man became very famous, so tabloids became fascinated with her romantic relationships and the ups and downs of that. And then she was romantically involved with George Jones. So then you show those same tabloid reporters this guy who's struggling with all these quote unquote demons. And, you know, it's like blood in the water and a bunch of sharks. They're not going to ever leave that alone. So they start circling, you know, and then the divorce happens, the relationship blows up. So everyone's paying attention to George and Tammy separately. And he, at that time, then became addicted to cocaine, which led to far more self-destructive behavior in a much more public way. And the popular theory was that he was doing this to himself because he was so brokenhearted over losing Tammy. And Billy Sherrill knew, everyone was saying that about him. And he knew once he heard He Stopped Loving Her Today, which, as you say, was written to be a comedy. It was written to be a joke. He knew that if he had George record it as if it wasn't a joke, everyone would hear it as a song about how he was still desperately in love with Tammy Wynette, which is, you know, what happened.
But there are lots of people in the world who feel that way. You know, they have that deep emotional, personal pain, and these songs resonate deeply with them. I mean, these are, they unlock of things in the brain that need to be processed. It's an important part of the human struggle.
Absolutely. It's very therapeutic. And in the book, there's a section where I get into a little bit of how songwriters actually perform this psychological trick of allowing us to attach our own lived experiences to what we're hearing this person sing about. And in a way, I think that they're sort of helping us process our own emotions, as I think you just said.
Yes, cathartic. Very important to us. That's why, you know, the Greeks, they mandated that people would attend the plays in order to help them process their emotions. You know, and so now we have reality TV. Or what if reality TV had taken on at the time? I mean, basically, it kind of was reality TV just played out in country music songs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that you could say that for sure. Billy Sherrill's approach to, because he had a crew of songwriters who he was telling them, I want you to write songs that seem as if they are pieces of autobiography from this person that the fans are reading about in tabloids. So we're going to give them something that feels like a look into this person's real life behind the curtain. But as reality TV does now, much of that is not true. And with reality TV, it's also the producers behind the scenes who are the crafting what we see on the screen.
But I want to get back to what you were talking about when we went to a break about Tammy Wynette. And I've totally bought the whole thing about her growing up basically as a sharecropper's daughter. Kind of like life, but you'd say that wasn't true at all. And, you know, I had picked that up this through the consuming biographies of her throughout life. And, you know, and then Bob Allen written the George Jones biography, Life and Times of a Honky Tonk Legend. And were these people that would produce these products, they were also part of the Nashville scene. So were they invested in trying to preserve the myth of these characters who were country music stars and actually real people? And what I like about your work is that you're doing so much detective work to kind of like show the pieces that, you know, this doesn't make any sense. Let's reexamine what really happened here.
Yes, I don't tend to lean on my background in country music and my lifelong proximity to it. I don't ever say just trust me because I know what I'm talking about, but I do believe that it helps me spot inconsistencies when it comes to the way things work in the industry and my familiarity with it. If I see a source of information saying something that doesn't ring true to what I know of how the industry works, then it sort of sends up a red flag for me. And I can start paying much closer attention to everything that they're saying. And it helps me to spot these inconsistencies.
Yeah. And so Tammy Wynette, she faked her own kidnapping, right?
That does seem to be the case. Yes. She was allegedly abused by the man she married after George Jones. And it would seem that he
hit her in the face and left a small mark that she was worried about people noticing and wondering about. So it seems they needed to concoct this big event of her being abducted from a shopping mall and sort of left for dead in the middle of a field. And she kind of like never backed away from this being a thing that really happened, even though it required her applying fake bruises to her face with makeup, which, I mean, you can go back and find video of all of this stuff. And it's just very clear that what she's claiming happened is not what happened. And then her own story over the years, you know, it gets hard to remember. Once you start lying about something, it gets hard to remember all of the things you said. So her own story just kept contradicting itself as it went on. And it was very detrimental to her career. A lot of her fans who stuck with her through everything else, they just couldn't handle seeing someone lie so continually.
Your story of how you put together this podcast and how it became a hit is also fascinating. You're not trained to be this, but I can look behind you on some of your things on YouTube. I can see all the books that you have, and that, you know, you apparently, you know, have an encyclopedic knowledge of country Western music, and not just that, and beyond it, just the history of Western civilization and beyond. And I guess that's you have just done this through your own personal curiosity.
Well, my grandmother taught me how to read before kindergarten, so you know how the other kids, you start being assigned book reports and the other kids just see it as homework. I was already reading books. So if you want me to write you a report on the books that I'm reading, then that's just an extra thing. You know, I kind of always saw it as fun, not a chore. And I think that has served me very well.
But being able to apply that to country music, which, you know, has been looked down on, you're elevating it as an art form. You're looking at the moving parts inside of it, and you're showing us that inside it's a very complex machine that has so much to offer.
Yeah, it's just the people who were doing this were much smarter than they've been giving credit for, you know.
Well, I mean, I really appreciate your work. Thank you so much, Tyler Mahan Coe. The book is Cocaine and Rhinestones, A History of George Jones and Tammy Wynette. The podcast is available, and you could also get the book. It is filled with interesting stories. Appreciate it. Thanks for coming on, Tyler.
Thank you so much for having me, David. I had a great time.
And that's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
And the clock just now struck 10. Darling, I had to call you to our favorite place again.
We know it's wrong for us to meet, but the fire's gone out at home,
and there's nothing cold as ice here after the fire is gone. No.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted and produced by David Martin Davies. Kayla Padilla is our booking and engagement producer. Engineering support from Ruben Garcia, Jesse Reeves, and Steve Short. Dan Katz is TPR's Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.